Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Noah Hawley is the award-winning creator of shows like Fargo and Legion and the best-selling author of Before the Fall. His new novel, Anthem, is a deep plunge into American life that is thrilling, vivid, hopeful, and disturbingly current. Something is happening to teenagers across America, spreading through memes only they can parse. At the Float Anxiety Abatement Center in suburban Chicago, Simon Oliver is trying to recover from his sister's tragic passing. He breaks out to join a woman named Louise and a man called the Prophet on a quest as urgent as it is enigmatic. Noah Hawley is one of the most accomplished storytellers working in television, film, and literature. Over the course of his more than 20-year career, his work as a novelist, screenwriter, series creator, showrunner, and director has garnered acclaim, winning an Emmy, a Golden Globe, Penn, Critics' Choice, and Peabody Award. Again, his new novel is Anthem, and it's a pleasure, a great pleasure, to welcome Noah Hawley to this week's book show. Noah, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this novel, and it's really interesting because it comes at a time where we've all been through a lot over the last 2.5, 3, 7 years, I don't know. It seems like we've been through a lot, and this novel certainly looks at that. I have two origin questions. One is the very back of the book says, "This isn't a fairy tale." Why did you feel that was important to have in such a big font on the back of your novel?
You know, it's something I said in discussing the book with the publisher, and they seized on it as a promotional line. You'd have to ask them on some level why they felt that way. I mean, I think there's something interesting that happens in the last section of the book. I start the book by speaking to the reader directly as the author, and I end the book the same way. And right. You know, at the end of the book, I talk about how my daughter asked me how the book was going to end, and I said, I really don't know. And, you know, I talk about how people want things to work out, right? They want love stories to work out and families to stay together and, you know, in other words, a fairy tale. And so I suppose this isn't a fairy tale, or at least it's not clearly a fairy tale, as you know, as we do end the book with a certain amount of hope for our characters.
But it is very real. It is very realistic. It brings us to what we are living through right now. While it has fantastical elements, it is a very realistic novel.
Yeah, it's, you know, the challenge that I had, I set out to write a story about people. And one of the questions you always ask when you're starting out is, okay, well, who's in the book? Where is the book set? And when is the book set? And in thinking about the when, I thought, well, I certainly want when the reader picks up the book, for the book to feel relevant to that moment, right? Which, if I had that thought in 2018 or 2019, I was probably looking right around this time. And that forced me to ask, okay, well, America in 2018 seems to be changing every hour. So what is it going to look like in 3 or 4 years? And that ended up becoming a big part of the book, was that was literally trying to figure out what the when was and how the country was going to be, which also led to another kind of revelation to me, which was, you know, this book has all of the hallmarks of a fantasy novel, a quest story, where, you know, these characters go on a quest with a certain amount of magic realism to it. But the country that they move through is not Mordor, right? Or, you know, or Westeros. It's America. You know, they go from the kingdom of Wall Street into the kingdom of Main Street. And so all of those sort of tropes of the fantasy novel, I started to apply just to the world that we're living in today, with wizards and trolls and the like. And that became an interesting way of thinking about it. You know, there's a moment in the book where this guy who's called the Prophet, who's a 15-year-old boy, you know, he's talking about how 30-something of Americans believe that angels and demons walk among us. And he's asked what he believes. And he says, Well, I believe the more people believe it, the realer it gets, right? Which isn't necessarily how things work. And yet there's a sort of precept in the book that that may in fact become true, that we're entering the magic realism phase of American democracy.
The other origin question I had that you write several times in the book, you use this word several times in the book, and you do talk about its derivation, but I am curious as to how it came to be a part of this book, which is the very simple word or phrase, which is boo fooey, which
yes.
Now has infiltrated the lexicon of the Donahue household. It's a great phrase, but it explains a lot too, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I'm looking at the book that it comes from right now, which is this old children's book called The Thing in Dolores's Piano, published in 1970. It's a very 1970 thing to say, it feels like to me, which is basically, you know, a story that my mother read to me and a phrase that she kind of adopted after that book, in which this young girl is playing the piano so horribly that the notes in the piano come out and tell her to stop. And she has to go into the piano to get the piano turned back on again. And she does it basically by tricking them and blackmailing them. And in response, the notes in the piano say boo fooey, by which they mean that's not fair. And we don't like the way the story ended. Right. And so I give the reader permission at any point to throw the book across the room and say boo fooey. because of course, you know, it's on you as the reader. You're either enjoying the ride or you're not enjoying the ride. It is in my lexicon as well as a kind of expression of, well, you know, sucks to you.
Right. You know, at the very first in the author's note, it says this book contains math. That's the first words in the book. And I'll admit to you, Noah, that when I read that, I thought, oh, boy, I don't like math books. And yet it does contain math. But it's interesting that you started with that, because what you're talking about are these very real life statistics and numbers that may or may not affect us deeply, but probably should.
Yeah, I mean, the book is filled, I guess, more accurately with statistics. I don't think reading that would have been better for you.
Probably not.
But this idea that you know, we have all these very quantifiable dilemmas in our society. The math of climate change, the math of gun violence, you know, the math of casualties in our 20-year war. You know, all these numbers are really meaningful. The number of COVID deaths and hospitalizations and numbers that we're all really obsessed with anymore. And yet, you know, that math is really relevant to the kingdom of Wall Street, in which we are a science-based, you know, fact-oriented kingdom. But, you know, in the kingdom of Wall Street, where it is a more intuitive, more emotional experience of the world, the facts are really relevant, because in the kingdom of Main Street, feelings are also facts.
Noah Hawley is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the novel is Anthem. You mentioned the prophet as a character a moment ago. The prophet says in the novel at one point, "What is this world our parents are giving us if not a disaster?" And we see that in several ways in this. And in fact, all of these disasters sort of come together as a culmination. But it is very much a novel about what these kids, our young people, our teenagers, are, that we're giving them, and what they're up against in the future.
Yeah, and I think also it you have to look at it from their point of view, in terms of, here are clearly the problems that the world is facing, and here is the clear evidence that our parents aren't solving them. They're not even addressing them on some level. You know, the solutions to the biggest problems of our time are stuck in state houses. They're stuck in blue ribbon panels. They're stuck with adults who keep saying, well, it's complicated. Whereas, you know, our children know that it's not complicated either. the planet heats up or it doesn't heat up. Either we stop gun violence or we don't stop gun violence. You know, it's very binary, actually. And so I think that's part of the mission of the book is you know, to try to really point out to adult readers, which is who the book is written for, the, let's say, the irony of the way that we're living and approaching this, which is, you know, we have problems that are solvable, but we can't seem to solve. And is it a problem of will, or is it a problem of a sort of cynicism in which, you know, people run for government who want to destroy government? The irony of that idea that you would get an elected office in order to make sure that elected office can't accomplish anything. You know, it's this phrase I came up with during the writing of Fargo, which is that irony without humor is just violence. This idea that that it sounds like a joke, but it's not funny.
You have a teenager in the book by the name of Randall Flagg, who meets Simon, who's the protagonist that I mentioned in the introduction. And Simon asks Randall, who survived Parkland, we should note. And Simon says, isn't that a fictional character from a Stephen King book? And Randall says, it's a fictional world. Why can't I be a fictional character? And that explains a lot about where these characters are coming from, where these kids are coming from.
There's a lot of crossover in the book between fantasy and reality. And you know, when they reach the parts of the nation in which, you know, they're facing a sort of escalation of violence, some of it from what in 2018 we called the alt-right, you know, a lot of it is based in fantasy and sort of almost a cosplay reality in which, you know, you just have to think back to the events of January 6th and the sort of costumage that we saw, where it wasn't, you know, angry citizens storming the Capitol. It was angry citizens dressed in a sort of performance art, approach with the, you know, the QAnon shaman and other characters, whereas almost like in order to foment a kind of revolution, they had to choose an avatar first. And so the book has in it, it has a number of Tyler Durdens from Fight Club. It has, you know, some war boys from Mad Max Fury Road, you know, people who quite seriously have adopted these avatars as their way of interacting with the world. It's almost like there is no first draft of history set in reality that will later be fictionalized, but that history is being fictionalized from the very beginning.
I think it's interesting when you talk about the politics about the book, because never in the book do you use Democrat or Republican. Instead, you look at the party of truth and the party of lies. But each party believes that they're the party of truth. So if you're the party of truth, then the other party is the party of lies. If you're the party of lies, then the other party. So it slips. That's the way you deal with the politics of the book.
Yeah, there are a number of exercises I take in the book, the sort of analogies. You know, there's one character who thinks of it, the difference between surfers and swimmers, where you have one party that feels like there's the party of surfers, where they are independent, floating above the ocean, making their own choices, whereas the party of swimmers believes that the current is taking them, the current of history is taking them. Or another analogy is cooks and drinkers, you know, that the party of cooks, you know, wants this big sort of Norman Rockwell meal, everyone is welcome. And the party of, you know, drinkers, it's more of a sports bar, you know, where all that matters is that our team win. So there are a number of ways that I sort of look at not the politics by name, but the sort of outlook of the different parties, because I really didn't want to write a political book, political meaning he's chosen a side. Right. Forget the politics used to mean civic discourse. Now it means you've chosen a side when they say you're being political. And I know it's almost impossible to escape at this moment this idea that things are political, everything is political. But I did think it was important to say, well, you know, we're all trapped in this language that we use, but the language itself is breaking down, because what I mean when I say freedom, right, and what someone else means when they say freedom, it might be two totally different things. And so how do you have a conversation anymore when the language itself is polarized?
One of the things that is at the heart of the book is this idea of suicide and how that becomes contagious among the young people, which is another way to explore many of these issues, that idea of a contagiousness of ideas.
Yeah, I mean, there is this sort of stickiness of ideas, you know, is something that people are definitely very vulnerable to. You know, even when it comes to sort of fact and fiction, the more often that a lie is repeated, the more people are likely to believe it. You know, we have the best brains that have been developed on this planet, and they're still really bad at a lot of the things that we need them to do, which is to, you know, to keep us safe. They're pretty good at that, but when you get into more esoteric areas, you know, they're problematic. And so this idea of suicide, which we have seen, you know, you'll have these outbreaks in communities because, you know, because it is a contagious idea, unfortunately, and you do have copycats, incidents, et cetera. You know, but what I was looking at, and this was before COVID, you know, I was looking at what seemed like a huge escalation of anxiety in children, my children, your children, everybody's children, that has only been made worse by COVID, the lockdowns, and how fractionalized we have become and polarized we've become. I mean, when you think about how anxious you are and I am in just trying to navigate the world right now, I mean, that our children know that, they feel that. And I'm sure they're feeling, well, if my dad is this worried, then I should be twice as worried, because I think, you know, he seems pretty good at navigating this world. You know, I do think that, like any sort of contagiousness, it can get out of hand. And if it gets out of hand, how do we address it?
Noah Hawley's new novel is Anthem. It is published by Grand Central. There is this idea, too, of that kids are grappling or looking at the issues that adults are figuring out, like, oh, well, who's the real president? Half people say it's this guy. Other people say, well, it's this guy. And what do kids make of that? What do teenagers make of that? And are we forcing them ultimately to pick a side and to pick an ideology?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the old Soviet Union, they used to have this thing called free and fair elections. And a free and fair election in the Soviet Union was you show up at the polling place and they hand you a ballot that's already been picked out and you put it in the box. And you know, what's horrible about that is two things. One, of course, you don't get a vote, really. But the other thing is that the language itself has been corrupted. So if you then want to hold an actual free and fair election, what do you call it, right? Because the phrase has been taken away from us. And I do feel like it's a worry that I put into the book, which is, what do we have to teach our children in order for them to prosper in a world in which reality itself is polarized? It's not something you or I had to worry about when we were growing up. We had our own fears about, you know, nuclear war or whatever it was at the time. But this idea that I'm going to send my children out into a world, and depending on where they are, you know, literally what they think of as literal reality is can't be agreed upon. I'm not sure how to equip them to have that conversation when they go out in the world.
I think it's fascinating. We touched on this earlier, but I'd like to go back to it for a moment. And that is your use of your voice, of the author's voice, that is several places throughout the novel where you enter. And it's I guess you could say that you are a character, but it is you, right? I mean, it is the novelist that is talking to us and sharing what you're going through in telling this story.
Yeah, I mean, a big inspiration for me for this book and trying to figure out how to put all these very disparate pieces together was Slaughterhouse-Five, the Kurt Vonnegut novel, yeah. which starts with him trying to figure out how to write this book about, which is a fictionalized version of his World War II experience. And how he decides to write it is to make almost a science fiction book out of it, in which the character, his avatar going through the story, is unstuck in time and is literally jumping around through all these moments in his life. And then at a certain point is kidnapped by aliens and taken to another planet. And all the while, you know, Kurt Vonnegut is popping in from time to time to speak directly to the reader. There's, you know, he draws his own cartoons in the book. None of this stuff should work together, but instead what it creates is this sort of perfect moral document about war and that we send our children to war. And so when I was looking at how to tell this story, this sort of sprawling fantasy novel about our real world or realistic novel about our fantasy world, I thought, well, I don't want to hide behind the story. I feel like I need to get out front of it and say to the reader, you know, look, I'm worried about my kids and my country and my world, and I know that you're worried too. And so let's talk about it. I'm going to tell you a story, and I'm not going to pretend that that the story is real, you know, but I'm going to try to reflect the world I'm living in back, you know, as a story. And I'm going to come in from time to time to say, I mean, at one point I apologize for the book that I've written, because I know it's ridiculous. But right. If my job as a writer is to reflect reality as I'm experiencing it, what am I supposed to do when the world I'm living in has become ridiculous? Not funny, right? It's not a joke, haha. But it's ridiculous in that, like, you can't make this stuff up.
You write in that section, but if the author's job is also to reflect reality as he perceives it onto the page, then what is he meant to do when the world he lives in loses all sense? Consider this. As he writes, 34% of his neighbors have gone to war against tiny pieces of fabric worn across the nose and mouth. They believe these tiny pieces of fabric are robbing them of their personal freedom. And so they have declared war against these pieces of fabric, even as scientists present evidence that those same tiny pieces of fabric will protect them from a deadly virus sweeping the globe, killing millions. But for the 34%, the fabric, not the virus, is the enemy. And so they lie dying in hospitals from a disease they argue does not exist. In simpler times, this would have been called irony. But your author would like to point out, dear reader, that the times in which he lives stopped being simple long ago. In the new times, the age of tribal thinking, the age of inverted reality, irony has been stripped of its humor. I would like to pick one word out of that, which I think is just an amazing paragraph. You use the word tribal. There's a lot in this book about tribes.
Yeah, and tribes not in a negative sense, right? Always. I mean, a tribe, it's a group of people that you choose. You know, it's different than a family. You know, Sebastian Younger has a great book called Tribes, you know, which is looking at many levels at soldiers and that, you know, you create this tribe. But like anything, I mean, it has a margin within which it's a positive thing. And then if you get outside of that, it starts to become a negative thing, because, you know, once you're in an us versus them mindset, you know, no good comes out of that. And so, you know, as I say in the book, it's like, to pick out the mask issue in and of itself, that we have turned, you know, a public health crisis into a battle over free will and freedom and independence is on some level a sign that all we're really looking for is a fight, and we don't care what we fight about. But if you believe this, then I'm going to believe the other thing. It's like the star-bellied Sneetches, right, in Dr. Seuss. Right. You know, there's the ones with the stars and the ones without. And when the ones without get stars, then the ones with stars take them off. And it becomes this whole chain of events in which the guy who has the machine to add stars or take them away is getting rich and everyone else is going crazy.
One of the things that I'm interested in as we wrap up our time together is that it seems that whether it is writing a novel or writing for television or writing for film, you have that luxury now, don't you? You can figure out what is best, the best way to tell the story that you want to tell.
Yeah, and it is a luxury. I mean, I don't take it for granted at all that I've had enough success in all three mediums, film, television, and literature, that I can have a story pop into my head and think, oh, is it a book or is it a show or is it a film? And you know, what I found over time is that it kind of sorts itself based on, you know, on a few criteria, which I've never taken the trouble to list. But you know, a book is more for me, more of an idea driven story, which is not to say that it's not character driven, but it always really starts with question for me that I try to figure out a story, engine that will allow me to explore, certain themes and ideas, you know, and that work definitely goes into a show like Fargo as well. But, you know, it is more character driven, more outside in on some level. And so, you know, I do have that luxury. And, you know, in TV, we get to interact with the culture mostly in real time. You're maybe a few months behind. But with a book, you have to think, okay, well, this story is interesting now, but will it be interesting 5 years from now? Is it worth spending all this time on it? Is it going to be meaningful to people 5 years from now?
Again, Noah Hawley's new novel is Anthem. It is published by Grand Central. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.